You're listening to the podcast of Hillside Christian Fellowship. Hillside is a community of believers in Millersburg, Pennsylvania. We hope you are blessed and encouraged by this week's message.
I've been thinking a lot about this moment that Israel was at the Red Sea, and in prayer this morning, there was a great word that came forth about being on a seesaw, kind of like a scale. And the scales were tipped one direction, and then God, I know I'm going to bungle it up now. God came and stepped on the other end and just flipped the enemy right off the side that he was standing on. And when that was shared, I got this picture, and this is my cartoonish mind from spending too much time in front of the television when I was in my formative years. But Israel was at this Red Sea moment. And you ever wonder why God does what he does the way he does it? Because they're set free. They've been in bondage now for 10 generations. 400 years. They've never known. They've long since forgotten what it was like not to be slaves. They had been so embodied in slavery, they didn't know how to think any other way. And as you read through Exodus and see what happened once they got set free, it was easy enough for God to get Israel out of Egypt. Getting Egypt out of Israel was a whole other matter. So to help them to think differently. So God did all of these things, and he does these kind of things in our lives too, to help us to understand who he is and to see him as he is. Because in our minds, we so limit God. We just really think that God always has to do things in a way that we would be able to predict if we just figured it out the right way. Right? So you keep getting all these clowns that know that they figured out when Jesus is coming back and all that. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have called them clowns, but it's just ridiculous. If Jesus didn't know when he's coming back, why do you think you're going to figure it out? I'm just saying, So we think, man, once I got God figured out, and the problem with that is any God who could be confined to the limitation even of our own imagination is no God worth worshiping. If God's God, that means he's outside of any box we could ever create. Pagan faith is based on what we could create into a God. And that's who Israel had been under for 10 generations. They'd been under and serving even the gods of Egypt. Why do you think they made a golden calf when Moses took too long to come down the mountain? They were worshiping the gods of Egypt too. They'd forgotten who their God was. And so God would show up in these powerful ways, right? 10 plagues to get them out of Egypt. He could have just gone right to the firstborn thing on day one. And I think Egypt would have said, okay, enough's enough. But to just show Israel, I love you, I am more powerful than anything you could ever come up with or they could ever come up with, I'm going to judge all of Egypt's gods right in front of your face. And then just to make sure you get it, even though Pharaoh said, yeah, get out of my country, you can go, you're free, I'm going to make him chase after you. And I'm going to lead you into a place where you're trapped by the wilderness on three sides, and then on the other side of you is the sea. And it just ain't nowhere to go. You know those kind of situations in life? You know what I'm talking about? We call it between a rock and a hard place, where there's just absolutely no conceivable answer. How is this situation ever going to turn around? I can't even imagine, we might say, how God could make something good out of this. I can't even fathom how, in God's name, that life will turn around. This situation will change. It feels totally hopeless. And it's like God took Israel to a place where on purpose, they're in a hopeless situation. There is nothing they could do. They're free. They're there. And here comes Pharaoh's army, 600 chariots strong, ready to either drive them into the sea or take them back into captivity. And the people are freaking out. That's what we're going to look at in the message today. But it just hit me how God just, he loves setting things up, and he uses us as bait. Behold, I send you out as lambs among wolves. We think those wolves are so excited. Lunch. And God dangled Israel there, stuck in the wilderness, and Pharaoh got all cocky and said, they're lost. Moses forgot his GPS. He's a man. He's not going to ask for directions. He's lost in the wilderness. We got him right where we want him now. And God did it on purpose so that he could drown Pharaoh and all of his chariots so his people could see them gone right in front. So God's like, I didn't punish you hard enough yet for 400 years of enslaving my people, killing their firstborn when Moses' generation was born. Now I'm going to drown you, and I'm going to use my people as bait. So he sets us up. He puts us in these situations in life. Instead of freaking out about it, Instead of getting anxious and shaking and how is this going to work out? And we got all these muddled thoughts of what we're going to do. We just need to stand still, as Moses said, and see what God's going to do together with us. But it reminded me when Steve shared that word in pre-service prayer, you know those Roadrunner cartoons? See, all the young people are like, what are you talking about? They were the best cartoons of all time. Hours in front of the TV when I was 8 years old. Bugs Bunny, Looney Tunes, Roadrunner. And always what it was this Wile E. Coyote, right? He was trying to catch the Roadrunner, so he'd buy these products from Acme, bombs and anvils and traps and all these kind of things. And every time he set it up, like the anvil falls on his head. And the trap springs and catches him in it, and he ends up blowing up in the middle of it. And I felt like God gave me a word for us. The next time we're feeling hemmed in and trapped and hopeless, instead of praying, instead of crying out to God, just say, meep, meep. You're going to have to watch them if you don't know what I'm talking about. That's it. Man, because it's like if you're a Wile E. Coyote, that's the most annoying sound in the world to you after you've been blown up, hit on head with an anvil and trapped in a cage. Meep, meep. God puts us in places on purpose because he wants to teach us how to rest in him, but also to enter into heaven's atmosphere. Do you know what God does when all the nations conspire against Jesus? Do you know what it says he does in Psalm 2? He laughs. He just laughs. Oh, that's adorable. Oh yeah, you're going to stop Jesus. That's hilarious. Let me set you up by sending my people out, gentle, harmless as doves. Wise as serpents, harmless as doves. And watch how the enemy is always going to have that anvil pop on his head. I'm always, God says, going to turn his plans over against him. And I'm going to be glorified, and you're going to be amazed, and you're going to enter into this restful walk with me, where you're going to know that nothing ever formed against you is ever going to prevail against you. Because it's not your battle, it's mine. Whatever harms you touches the apple of my eye, God said. The devil messes with you, he's poking God in the eye. You don't want to do that. So Moses was able to lead Israel in that moment. How many of you know that's a moment of truth if ever there was one? You got a million plus people terrified. You're trapped with the most powerful army in the world coming downhill at you, and there's an ocean on the other side of you. If ever there was a moment of truth in the Bible, that was it. And only one man in a million people who had seen all of God's signs and wonders was able to stay calm, hold his ground, stand firm, as we started looking at last week, and give a word that literally brought peace to an entire multitude. You know what crowds do when they freak out, right? You ever see like these stampedes at concerts or Black Friday at Walmart? You know how people get when they just get crazy about stuff. They could have stampeded Moses. Single-handedly, Moses brought down the peace of heaven into that place, spoke a word, and the whole crowd got quiet. And that's what he's able to do through each and every one of us in our various places, wherever God has us. That is our role. Our role is to become a Moses. A Moses, a one who can stand firm and watch what God's going to do in the middle of that. But until we have an encounter with a living God, until we've gone face to face, till we do what we talked about, this rite of passage retreat, we got our own encounter with God. I'm not living a secondhand life in God. I'm not living based on what I heard preached or heard on a podcast or watched on a video or heard somebody else's testimony. No. At some point in time, each and every one of us, we have to have our own like burning bush encounter with the living God. Know who we are and what our call is. Know what's in us from deep inside, that it's the kind of thing like, if I don't do this, I'm going to die. Even though I might be so terrified at the largeness of it that I feel like I'm going to die if I try to do it. God wants to bring us into those places, because until we have that encounter, that thing that's in us to do, we'll try to do it by means of striving rather than just do it effortlessly. How many of you know Jesus called us to bear much fruit? And this is my Father glorified, he said, that you bear much fruit, and that's how you'll prove that you're my disciples. How much work does it take to bear fruit? Man, you just got to be alive. You just got to be alive and sucking up water out of the ground if you're a tree and getting the nutrients out of that and breathing the air around you and you just bear fruit. It's restful. It's as natural as breathing is for us. So how do we get to that place? Let's hop back into Moses' journey, because Moses didn't start out this way. We looked last week real quick how Moses grew up in Egypt and Pharaoh's palace, had this identity crisis. I'm living right now in Adolf Hitler's house and my people are Jews. And I know that my people are Jews because I lived with my family till I was like 3-5 years old. And now I'm in this palace who's oppressing my people, killing them, enslaving them. They're just doing all this crazy stuff to my people. So he has this identity crisis. And the reason why what God was impressed with about Moses in Hebrews 11 wasn't any of the miracles that he did. It was all about how he was not willing to enjoy the passing pleasures of Egypt. He said, yeah, I live in the palace. I'm all set. You know, I'm over here dining with the king, living a prince's life. But there's something deep in me that knows I am called to set those people free, those Hebrews who actually are my people. And this justice thing was rising up in Moses. And it began finally to bubble up and boil over to the point where he killed an Egyptian. And it also says of him that when Moses did that, he kind of looked around expecting that Israel would understand that he was their deliverer. That's in Acts 7, the way Stephen tells the story. And he's kind of like, come on, guys, who's with me? I'm Spartacus. And they're ready to leave the slave rebellion. And the people were like, you ain't the boss of me. That's a paraphrase. They said, who made you Lord and Master over us? But you ain't the boss of me, sounds more. It's like, you, who put you in charge of us? You know, he caught these two guys fighting. He said, hey, come on, guys, break it up. You're not the boss of me. And they rejected Moses after he just started the big slave revolt they've been waiting for 10 generations. You know what's an amazing thing is that if we're not careful, we always miss God's deliverance when we're looking for it with a box. When we think this is how God's going to do it. So Israel had been crying out to God for a deliverer. Little did they know the deliverer had been growing up right in their midst. And his name was Moses. So they're crying out to God for him. Then Moses, in his own strength and his own wisdom, said, we'll kill these Egyptians one at a time. And Israel said, yeah, not that way. Kind of reminds me how it was when Jesus walked the earth. Israel had been crying out for a Messiah. Their understanding was, he's going to set us free from Rome. So Jesus shows up on the scene and he's telling them, yeah, pay your taxes. You know, I'm not a zealot. We're not going to rebel against Rome. And yeah, no, I'm not going to sit on David's throne here in Israel. No, I'm going to set the whole world free. I got something bigger and better in mind. And they crucified him. We got to be careful, I'm saying, in how we look. And we miss God in these little places because we have this mindset or concept of this is how God's going to come through. This is how God's going to deliver me from that situation in my life. He comes in these unexpected ways and unexpected packages. And if we don't put on spiritual eyes, we can miss him right under our noses as Israel did. So Moses killed the Egyptian. Once he found out it was known, it says that he fled. He was striving in his own strength. We'll give him a little pass here. He didn't know God yet. He'd been raised under all the gods. Heck, his father was the son of the sun god, Ra. He'd been raised by a god as far as he knew at that point. But there was something stirring in him. So he booked it out of there and he left Egypt and says that he came to the place of Midian. So we'll pick up his story there. Moses fled from the presence of Pharaoh and settled in the land of Midian. The name Midian literally means striving, which was exactly what Moses had been doing all his life. It was the only way that Moses knew how to do things. Moses is going to murder somebody to set people free. Moses is going to get things done because he's strong, he's powerful, and he knows how to get her done. His father was the sun god after all. So he came to this place of striving, now being broken. He'd been rejected by Egypt. Pharaoh was going to kill him for what he did. And he was rejected by his birth people, his biological people. So he's a man without a country. It says he came to Midian, and there it says he sat down by a well. And that's not just a nice place to hang out. We don't know how long Moses was there. If I was writing the script for a movie about Moses, I'd have him there like for days and weeks. with the wind blowing past him and all the last little bits of whatever dress he wore, whatever nice garments he had from Egypt, all that little by little being stripped away. So all that's left is this man sitting by a well, drawing water from it to sustain himself. He didn't have a clue where to go next. He knows he can't go home. He doesn't know where he's going. He's literally wandering around in the same wilderness that he'd bring a million people. And he's sitting there by this well, drawing from it. And all of a sudden, here come these seven women. The priest of Midian had seven daughters. And they came to draw water, and they filled their troughs to water their father's flock. So the same well that Moses is learning to drink from, these seven women come and they're starting to draw water from it. And then some shepherds came by, it says, and Moses stood up and, you know, his justice thing got kicked in and he drove the shepherds away. And then he looked and he said, ooh, that one's pretty attractive right there. One of them was going to be his wife. Don't worry where I'm going with this. Zipporah was there. He said, ooh, let me water your flock for you. That's a cheesy pickup line if I ever heard. Can I water your flock? Sorry. He's drawing water out of this well and he's learning to drink. He's learning to drink from a source of water that's deep, and there's something spiritual about to happen in Moses' life too. Because all his life he'd lived this fake life. He'd been posing all of his life. A Hebrew slave posing as a child of the king. All of his life, he'd had these fake identities. One sociologist called it a patchwork self, where you become whatever people have told you you're supposed to be. And you don't know who you are anymore. And on the deepest end of it, he's like, I'm adopted into Adolf Hitler's family, and this is my people, and I don't know who I am anymore. But he's now, with all of that stripped away, learning how to draw water from a well. This man who had cupbearers come with golden or silver chalices to give things, he's drawn water out of his own well. And he's learning some things in the natural that he's now going to also learn spiritually. Because it says that the daughters went back to their father, whose name was Reuel. And he said, oh, why'd you come back so soon today? Reuel is the actual given name of the man that we usually call Jethro. Jethro, soon to be Moses' father-in-law. Jethro was his title. It means like the sheikh, the exalted one. That's what Jethro is. But Reuel, his actual name means a friend of God. A friend of God. The first thing we need when we finally come to that place where we recognize, hey, you know, everything I used to depend on, everything I'd been striving to be and to do, even though I felt like it came from deep inside, I've always been striving, always been working hard to get this thing. The thing that we need the most is to hang around some friends of God who know how to be a friend of God. Because by hanging around with people who understand what it means to be intimate with God, that's how we learn how to be intimate with God. The key to discipleship, the key to helping somebody grow in God, isn't to open the Bible and teach 10 doctrinal points to help them understand God and their minds better. No, the key to growing in God is to hang around people who know how to be intimate with Him. Pray once with somebody who weeps when they pray, and you'll never pray the same again. Open the Word up once with somebody who lets the revelation of the page speak to their heart, and study the Word with somebody like that, and you'll never study the Word the same. Live life close to somebody who recognizes and lives the way that, like Paul said it, in Him I live and move and have my being, and you'll never live the same way again. And so Moses, God recognized, you know what you really need, Moses, to help you come to know Me so that you can really get to know who you really are? You need to hang around one of My friends. So to prepare us for life's call, God gives us His friends to teach us how to become His friend. Because really the answers to all the questions that Moses had, they're not going to be found in another human being. They're not going to be found within himself. I remember talking with a relative of mine who's a counselor and asking, what's the problem with counseling? Why are you so against counseling? I'm not against it per se. It's just that the philosophy of counseling is you got to find your answers inside. Someplace, like be the real you, just, you know, all that kind of stuff. Just search deep within and you'll find out the answers to everything. And what I want to propose to you is that we'll never get the answers about who we really are So we get in touch with the God who's our friend and who created us. That there's a deeper part of who we are. There are a lot of people who know how to live from the inner man in terms of the soul, like from the heart, the will, the emotions. There are a lot of people that live from the heart that don't know God. But to live from the deepest part, the spirit, the part that connects to the supernatural realm, the part that existed before God laid the foundations of the earth, right? We were in Christ, Ephesians said, before he laid the foundations of the earth. That part of us, the only way for that to be satisfied is to finally get face to face with God and start hearing the answer to the questions that we've been asking in all the wrong places. So he gives us these things so that we can learn how to be real with God. I asked with the young men and women that we were, I had some alone time with them, and I encouraged them and asked, who are your five closest friends? They say you can tell everything you need to know about somebody by the five people that they spend the most time with. If you could just interview those five people, get to know their personality, their likes, their passions, their dreams, their way, that really can be, it's almost 100% accurate definition of that person. Well, what if you learn how to be friends with God? And he's in that circle of five that you're closest with. That's what Moses was in need of. That's the gift that God gave Moses. 40 years in the wilderness, God was going to learn how to be a friend of God, because the first thing there is about friends, and all of us have, you could call them circles of intimacy. Not everybody's invited all the way in, but you got certain people that are just really close, people that when you're with them, your verbal sensor gets turned off. You don't say things wondering what they're going to think about it. You just say it. You just pour your heart out there. Even if you say something dumb or something that, you know, you realize after the words came out, like, oh, that was a dumb thing to say, or that was wrong, that it doesn't matter, that you're able to be real with them. And God, I want to propose, since the beginning of time, has always been looking for people that are just willing to get real with him. Stop hiding behind that bush with your fig leaves on. Stop running from me when you mess up. Stop running from me when you feel ashamed about who you are, what you've done. I'm looking for friends. Every one of those people named in Hebrews 11, the chapter of the heroes of faith, as we call it, every one of them was called a friend of God. That's the only thing they had going for them. How many of you know God will prophesy through a donkey if he needs to speak his word? God wasn't looking at Moses and going, hey, you know, everybody submitted their resume for deliverer, and yours was the best one. We chose you to be our candidate for CEO of the deliverance ministry out of Egypt. Moses, you know, maybe Moses before his wilderness experience might have come to God saying, yeah, I know I'm the one, so I'm going to kill these Egyptians one at a time and I'll single-handedly set your people free. He might have thought, I'm the best candidate for the job. But by the 40 years of having all that stripped away and just living the simple life in the wilderness, where all Moses took was what was given to him. So God gave him a wife, a beautiful wife. God gave him two sons. First one's name means a stranger, and I'm an alien in a foreign territory. He got it. He finally got it. That, yeah, I'm a man without a country, but I'm through this friend of God whose house I'm in right now. I'm getting to understand this God, and I'm getting to walk and understand what life's really about. That it has nothing to do with all the trappings of the palace of Pharaoh. Has everything to do with the palace God wants to build inside of me. That in here is going to be the most beautiful thing in all creation. In here gets built a bride. You read the description of the bride in the book of Revelation, that's us. That's not some city. That's all metaphor for us. It's beautiful. It's breathtakingly beautiful. As breathtakingly beautiful as a bride is to her groom on the day of their wedding. And that's what God's working on the inside. He was finally ready to fulfill his calling, only this time, together with God, as friends do things. We're going to do this thing together. Mo, I'm calling you to set your people free. Now that you finally get it, that you're not going to do it without me, you're ready. If you feel unqualified for the call of God in your life, you just qualified yourself for it. I said, if you feel unqualified for the call of God on your life, you just qualified yourself. Because God's not calling qualified people. God, not once, with the exception maybe of Nehemiah, he's the closest I can find in the Bible to somebody who may have had the skill set of leadership enough to do that job that he had to do of building the walls of Jerusalem. He didn't do it without God's help. He was a man of prayer. I'm not saying he did it without God, but there's nobody in the Bible that had the qualifications to be what God said they were going to be. Not a one. So after 40 years in the wilderness, Moses is out there. He's just got a shepherd's staff in his hand, and he's got a flock of sheep belonging to his father-in-law. He didn't even have his own flock of sheep, and he's 80 years old. But he'd learned to just live a simple life. I just got my wife and kids, and I'm free of all that stuff I used to have to do in the palace. Life is good, and I'm just enjoying every day. And then just when he feels safe and secure, God comes back, shows up on the scene, and flips his life all around again. Brings back the pain of things that he 40 years ago left behind. Reminds him of the fact that you're enjoying this sweet, comfortable high life here in Jethro's, you know, whatever, Bedouin community. You're the son-in-law of the sheik, a wealthy man for sure, and you're living like this. But your people are still in bondage. You might be enjoying the comfortable thing of having your identity secured now and getting sealed and all of these things, but there's still people dying out there. There's still people who don't know the freedom that you know. There's still people that every day wake up with that same feeling that every one of us had before we came to know Christ, the heaviness of heart of having no real hope. Only how do I get by this day, and how can I grab hold of something I think might sustain me for a little while? My job, my hobbies, my pleasures, whatever it is. Well, these things, that there are people waking up every day feeling that way, without hope, real hope, and without God in the world. And so once we get secure, God comes back and rattles our cage and says, so now that you know who you are, I want to send you someplace. And guess what? I'm going to send you someplace that's going to remind you, maybe even, of all the pain that you once had. That place, that pit that you came out of, I'm sending you back into it, because I've got in mind not just to deliver you from all of that, but to deliver everybody out of it. So it says that Moses was pasturing the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Oreb, the mountain of God. Now, the mountain of God was called Oreb. Do you know what Oreb means? I don't remember either, because my notes aren't showing up. No, I'm just kidding. It means the place of devastation, of destruction, the place of solitude where everything is stripped away. And all you have is you and the God who lives in that mountain. And that's it. That's what Oreb refers to. This, by the way, is the mountain Moses would bring all the people of God back to have their encounter with God at the mountain, which was came with mixed results for them. So Moses came to that place, the mountain of God. Now God could talk to the real Moses. Now God had a man who wasn't, going to put on all the pretense of the man he tried to make himself out to be. No posers here. This is a man who's real and now ripe and ready for his encounter with God. So in this encounter, I'm not going to read the whole thing. Four questions that Moses has for God. And these are questions that all of us ask, all of us have to ask, that only God can give the answer to. It's all well and good to go to career counselors, to take up counsel with those who know us, to help us discern maybe our gifts and our calling. That's all well and good. But at the end of the day, every last child of God has to have a moment at the burning bush where it's just you and God being real, getting real. So Moses, at this point, he's not afraid to get real with God. None of God's friends were afraid to get real with him. Read the Psalms. David, the friend of God, he gets in God's face. What's wrong with you? Did you forget about me again? Do you see this? Do you even care anymore? That's David. That's like four Psalms wrapped up there for you. Friends get real with each other. So God shows up and say, hey, Mo, come on over here. Take your shoes off. You're standing on holy ground. So Moses, now remember, Moses doesn't really know God personally yet. He might know some things from Jethro about God, but he's talking to this bush, and this bush goes, Moses, I've heard the cry of my people, and I want you to go back and deliver them. Tell the Pharaoh, let my people go. And Moses asks the first and most important question we got to ask of God. Who am I? Who am I? In Moses' context, who am I that I should set these people free? I don't even know who I am. How am I going to go and stand there before Pharaoh? Who am I? There's only one being in the universe who can fully answer that question, and it's God. And the only way he'll get to answer that question is when we're willing to say, I'm done posing and I'm done suggesting to you who I am. I just want to hear your heart toward me. Who am I? What am I made to be? What am I called to do? Of course, first answer to that question is, well, you're my child. You're my son. You're my daughter. That's the first most important answer. Until we recognize that, no other answer to the question, who am I, is going to be complete. Because everything that we do is wrapped up in the fact that we're children of God, that we're beloved of Him, that He made us, that no matter what goes on in our lives, no matter what lies ahead, no matter what comes behind us, everything has been encompassed in the love of God, who knows how to even make the enemy's plans turn over on his head and turn them out for our good. That question, who am I? Moses asking it. You know, it's funny if you read it there, it's in Exodus 3, God never even answered the question. Wouldn't that be great to just get like a one-sentence answer? Who am I? Well, you're fill in the blank. God never answered the question. He just said, I'm going to be with you. That's it. Who am I? You're the one that I'm with. That's who you are. Because we want the answer, who am I? You know, we think like the world thinks, I'm a great and mighty whatever. I'm a mighty warrior. I'm a beautiful princess. Or, you know, I don't think women think like that anymore. But anyway, I'm whatever. You fill in the blank. And God's just saying, you know who you are? You know what establishes your identity? I'm with you everywhere you go. And I'll never leave you. I will never forsake you. That's who you are. You're the apple of my eye. You're the one I've set my attention on. When my eyes go to and fro around the earth, I'm looking at you because your heart's mine. That's who you are. So with that question answered, Moses is starting to squirm a little bit, talking to this bush. He's going, all right, so you're not going to, I thought maybe I'd get out of that one. With that, because now Moses recognizes he's been humbled by 40 years in the wilderness, and he's not even putting in his application for deliverer anymore. He's like, I'm pulling that. I realize now that was a massive failure. Massive failure. Pharaoh wants to kill me. People rejected me. I'm done with that deliverer thing. I'm going to be a shepherd. Little did he know that that's what shepherds do. It's just they do it with a different mindset than a king does it. Shepherds do it with a mindset that says, I care about every last one of these people in this thing, and we're going to take that hill, but there's not going to be, we're leaving no sheep behind when we do it. So Moses is trying to squirm out of it. His next question, he's like, all right, so you want me to go and tell Pharaoh, let these slaves go. They've had him for 10 generations. Pharaoh thinks he's God, and nobody believes me. Nobody believes that I'm the deliverer. So, who should I tell him sent me? What's your name? God, Bush, what's your name? So God answers and he goes, I am. That's a dangling participle, just so you know. I am what? I am, can you fill in the blank for me? So I'm going to tell him, I am sent me. All right, I am. And God said, you know what, that's going to be my covenant. I like that name. I'm going to use that. That's going to be my covenant name with my people. It's the word Yahweh or Jehovah, as we put it in our language. Yahweh. And after that name, for the rest of time, actually God had already been introduced to Abraham, another friend of God, by this name, Yahweh, Jehovah, which is where we get our, you know, we sing songs about it. Jehovah Jireh, Yahweh Yireh, if you want to say it in Hebrew. I am the Lord who provides. I am fill in the blank. I am whatever you need me to be. That's what I am. I am the God who loves you and cares about you. I am the God who sets you free. I am the God who restores your broken relationship. I am the God who provides when you're on your last dollar. I am the God who puts a roof over your head when you're homeless. I am the God who delivers you from that addiction. I am the God who makes you have a purpose and a life. I am everything that follows. I am. Tell him I am sent you. And by the way, Moses, now that you know my name, I want you to go to the elders of Israel, get them all together with your brother Aaron, and I want you to go to Pharaoh. And I want you to tell Pharaoh, there's a new sheriff in town, I'm paraphrasing, and you're going to let us go, or you're going to meet God too, like I did at the bush. That's what God told Moses to say. Well, see, all right, you know that he thinks he's God too, right? So, all right, let me get this straight. So I'm going to go, me, with my brother and the slave elders of Israel, and tell Pharaoh, you better let us go or else. Okay? So then comes the third question. Why me? Why would you put me in this position? Why would you choose me? Moses is like, you know, all right, so I'm going to go, but how will they ever believe me? Little old me, little old ragtag shepherd with a stick. Why would they believe me? Why would you choose me? You should choose somebody who is who I used to be 40 years ago. Somebody who thinks he's all that in a biscuit. Somebody who really is on his game or something like that. Not me, lowly old shepherd back here in the wilderness just trying to raise my kids. And God said to Moses, so what you got in your hand there, Moses? Oh, it's a stick. I found it, and I use it because I'm a shepherd now. I use it sometimes. I kind of nudge a sheep. I push that ram away when he's butting me up in the rear end, and I hold it, and it helps me to climb because I'm getting on in years. I'm 80, you know. It helps me to climb up this mountain where you had to put the bush. You couldn't put the bush in the valley. I had to schlep myself, 80-year-old self, all the way up the mountain to talk to you. So I got this stick. That stick was the embodiment of everything that Moses had become in the wilderness. That stick represented his new identity. What was his new identity? I'm a man who has absolutely nothing else, but I'm a shepherd. I shepherd my father's sheep faithfully, however many thousands of them there were. And I'll walk to the end of the wilderness. He didn't come to the west side of Mount Horeb to meet a burning bush. He didn't know that was coming. He was minding his own business, finding good grass for his sheep, his father's sheep. And all of a sudden, there's God on a mountain in a burning bush talking to him. I was wondering, like the sheep, this is another thing, cartoon Steve mind. The sheep are all there, and then Moses starts talking to this bush. Sheep are like, he'd been out here a little bit too long. Somebody get him something to drink or something. You know, he's talking to a bush now. Woo, all right. Why me? So, all right, God says, all right, Mo, you got a stick. I could work with that. Throw it on the ground. That's an odd request, but all right, I'll throw it on the ground. Turns into a snake. You know, a brave, bold. You know, we get Moses from, what's his name? What was the actor's name, though? Charlton Heston. Moses, you know, he's all strong like that up there. His chest is, he looks like a 28-year-old man when he's 80. Set my people go. This is Moses. The 80-year-old Moses in the wilderness, he throws his staff down, turns to a snake. He goes, ah! And he runs away from it. Had to be snakes. You know me and snakes. You know, come on. Had to be a snake, really? He throws it on the ground, turns to a snake. And God says, all right, now pick it up. Pick it up! You don't pick up a snake. He's like, grabs it by the tail. Whoop, it becomes a staff again. And then maybe God perceived that Moses wasn't convinced yet. I don't know, that would have been the end of discussion for me. So he's like, you need another sign, or I stick a hand inside your cloak. He's like, all right, now pull it out. Ah! It's got leprosy. His skin's peeling off his hand. Okay, I believe you. Put it back in your hand. Okay. Whew. Baby skin again. Okay. All right, I'll go. That would have been us, right? Not Moses. Moses, at this point, what God had done in the wilderness was Moses made him understand. You know that youthful zeal that we all have when we kind of have a sense of what we're supposed to do with our lives. And we're all like, yeah, baby, I could take that. I could take that mountain. That's who Moses used to be. But now Moses has gone toe-to-toe with the principalities and powers of Egypt and it nearly killed him. Gone toe-to-toe with principalities that had God's people bound and they rejected him. So now Moses is a little bit more humble. So he just needs to know. So what's God's answer to, why would you choose me? Because I'm going to give you supernatural power that you didn't have before and everybody's going to know that had to be God. I think all of us should be happy with the fact that if God uses any of us to do something extraordinary, the testimony is going to be, if God can use a clown like that, he can use me too. I want that to be my epitaph. If that clown could do it, I could do it too. That's a great testimony. That is our mutual testimony. Just so you know. If you're looking at me like, yeah, you might be a clown, but I'm not. You need 40 years in the back end of a wilderness too. Hopefully God could do it in like a few months. Because 80 years old today is a whole different thing than it was for Mo. So why am I choosing you? Because you're willing to give me what you have. All he had was a staff in his hand to offer God. That staff represented his ministry, his new heart. I'm going to care about these people. The palace I grew up in treated people like slaves. The house I've been enculturated into now treats sheep like their sons. We learn how to value people around here. We treasure every one of these sheep. I will fight off wolves with this staff if I have to. I'll fight lions and bears with this staff if I have to. Because that's how we do things around here in the new family I'm into. So why would you choose me? Because I'm going to take that staff that you gave over to me, and with it, God said, you're going to do my wonders. That staff is now anointed. Don't lose it. This Far Side comic, like Moses comes down off the mountain, right, and he's got this staff now, and he trips and breaks it. I'm sorry, maybe I shouldn't always share the things that come to my mind like that. But that staff is meaningful now, and so is whatever your current life experience is, your past life experience, whatever you've been doing faithfully for the Lord, that is your staff. Whatever it is God gave you to do, there is no such thing as secular work when you're a son or daughter of God. Whatever it is that you're doing is a staff. And if you let God anoint that staff, you let God anoint the work of your hands, that thing you're holding in your hand, you watch and see how God's going to do extraordinary things. I shared with, Isaiah, did you say you want to be an engineer? Yeah, I think it was you. We were talking about how does that glorify God? How can you, make a ministry out of that, being an engineer? And I shared with him, I should have looked it up. If God would have told me I was going to share this during the message, I would have looked it up, but he didn't until just now, so I don't remember. But one of the compound bows of something made about 15 years ago, there was a new breakthrough invention in compound bows. All the hunters are trying to figure it out right now. I don't have a clue, so it doesn't matter. And it was a dude in California who was part of Bill Johnson's church, invented this bow, and he got it because he was praying and asking God, I want to do something to glorify you, and I just build bows. I engineer them, I make them, I'm creative with it, but I want to do something awesome with this. And so as he was praying and devoting his life's work, which was making hunting bows to the Lord, he was laying in bed one night, and in front of him, he could see the designs and plans for this new way of making a bow. So you could go away from that and go, well, what's so spiritual about hunting bows? Of course, all Pennsylvania men know that hunting's a very spiritual experience. I'm not suggesting otherwise, mind you. But this man, God looked at him and said, you know what? If that's what you're doing, I'm going to help you to do it supernaturally. I'm going to give you supernatural revelation on how to solve that problem. Do you know how many groundbreaking scientists were men of God and women of God who sought God's help in finding answers to things? Everything we do is spiritual because we are not mere mortals any longer. We are spiritual people. And so God took that staff and he said, remember, put a bookmark in this. With that staff, you will do my wonders. And Moses says, yeah, but I'm not a good talker. He's desperate now. How many know? If you're trying to convince God, don't send me. This is like desperate. But I don't talk so good. And God kind of rolled his eyes. And this says actually God got angry at this one. So what about my weaknesses? And God said, who made the mouth? Who made you? Who makes great things and glorious things and weak things and ugly things? Who made everything? I made you. Are you telling me that I messed up when I made you, Mo? That I'm choosing the wrong guy right now because I goofed? That surely somebody who's going to lead a million people, you got to be trying to let my people, you got to be able to speak, right? And Moses, and God's like, Moses, getting a little tired of this conversation now. I mean, it literally said Moses, God got angry at this point. And then God gave him a concession. He says, you know what, Aaron will be your spokesman. But you know what's interesting when you read the rest of the story? It says it's Moses who's doing the talking. Aren't you glad that God's gracious like that? He wasn't faking Moses out. He wasn't saying, yeah, Aaron could do the talking, but and then you get there in front of Pharaoh and now, no, Mo, you speak. He just said, you know what, I'll if it'll help, your brother's pretty good at communicating. Of course, he also has the designs for making golden calves, which is why I didn't pick him, but I chose you, right? So you go, Moses, and I'm not taking no for an answer. So Moses goes, a changed man, because he's now had 40 years to have all the fake self stripped away, to be a real man having a real conversation with a real God. So now we come back to the Red Sea. Moses talks to Pharaoh, throws his staff on the ground, it turns to a snake. You know what the problem was, though? Two of the priests had staffs that could turn into snakes, too. Moses' snake ate the other snakes, but that's, you know, they could imitate some of God's miracles, which is why the miracles began to increase. Turn the water to blood in the Nile River. And then all of a sudden, all the way up to its darkness over all of Egypt, and only the houses where sons of the Hebrews lived had light. I mean, it doesn't get any more stark contrast than that. And that'll preach too, by the way, but I'm not going there. Having houses where it's light when it's dark outside. Do you think on the night of the Passover, there might have been a few Egyptians who invited themselves over for dinner by the end of all that? Like, so they're probably sidling up like, so what's going to happen next? Oh, all your firstborn are going to die. Can we come to your house tonight? I like lamb. I'll cook. I'll bring the lamb. Just let me come. All of these plagues, they finally get set free and they're leaving, not just free, but it says that the Egyptians, God compelled the Egyptians to give them gold and jewelry and like silver chalices and cups and all that. So it says the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh after they left, king of Egypt, and he chased after the sons of Israel as the sons of Israel were going out boldly. Get this picture. They just left. God just delivered them. All the firstborn in Egypt died. They all survived. They left hastily in the middle of the night, which is why they eat unleavened bread in the Passover. They left. And it says they're going out boldly. You could just see them with all kind of chip on their shoulder. Yeah, baby. Ours is the right God. Sun God Ra, my foot, put me under and make me a slave. Yeah, baby. Hey, let me see. Oh, look at all that stuff. Look at all this. All decked out with their jewelry. You know, a big gold clock around. around his, yeah. You know, and just all decked out with all this beautiful stuff. They go, yeah, we plundered them, baby. We're like an invading army. We took everything they had. They're all destitute. See how they like being poor and slaves. And they're going out like that. And then Pharaoh starts chasing them down with his chariots. And they're all going, yeah, baby. And they turn around and see the chariots. And they go, ah, we're going to die. And they start crying out to God. The Egyptians chased after them with the horsemen and the army. They overtook them camping by the sea beside one unpronounceable biblical name in front of another unpronounceable biblical name. And Pharaoh drew near. The sons of Israel looked, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them. So they became very frightened. And so the sons of Israel cried out to the Lord. That's progress, you think, isn't it? Come on, they cried out to God. They finally cried out to God after 400 years in slavery. They finally thought, maybe we should ask God for help. And that's why he sent Moses. That's in the story too, that's paraphrased. So maybe we should try it again. So they cry out to the Lord. And then they look at Moses. This is why people don't sign up for leadership. They look at Moses. What? There aren't enough graves in Egypt that you brought us out here to die? Why are you doing this to us? Why'd you bring us out here to die? God, help us. Moses, why'd you do this to us? Saying to Moses what they really want to say to God. Do you realize that? Every time you complain to a leader, every time we complain to a leader, we're really complaining about God. Because either we trust him to be sovereign enough to put the right people, leaders, parents in our lives. See, I said it. In our lives. And that he's sovereignly able to work through all the goofballs that he puts over us. Through all the sins and the mistakes, the weaknesses and failures. That he's sovereign enough to still keep our lives all about what his business is going to be in the midst of all that chaos. That he's able to do that. And so anyway, why did you do this way? Bring us out of Egypt. Isn't this what we told you? Leave us alone so we could serve the Egyptians. We'd rather serve the Egyptians than die here in the wilderness. There's Moses. You think there might be a little bit of pressure on Moses already? I mean, there's a sense of responsibility. He's a shepherd now, which all leaders are, by the way. This isn't about a role of pastor, as we call it today. All of us are shepherd leaders. If you have people that depend on you, you're a shepherd. If you're a supervisor at your workplace, you're a shepherd. If you're a father or mother, you're a shepherd. If you're a leader of any sort, a teacher, somebody who has people who depend on you, view yourself as a shepherd. And treat the people that God's put in your care like a shepherd takes care of his sheep. Read Psalm 23 and pray that, that God would make you that kind of a shepherd for the people who depend on your leadership. Because for sure, Moses now had a million people depending on him. And Moses said, this is where we started out with last week, don't be afraid, stand by and see the salvation of the Lord, which he'll accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you've seen today, you will never see them again forever. Now he's prophesying. He's got the attention of the people. I don't know how much Moses knew exactly what was going to happen next. But Moses, a man who had spent time alone with God, had his identity, his calling, and the fact that God was with him confirmed, could stand in the middle of total chaos and be a beacon of peace. To be like a supernatural radiating source of, with an army charging downhill and a sea on the other side. So then Moses said, the Lord will fight for you. So just shut up. That's how I would have said it. Moses was kinder. I mean, I'm like, you know, this would be a lot easier without you yelling at me. You ever try to do something? Like maybe some of you are repairing something, you're trying to do good customer service, and the customer's yelling at you while you're trying to solve their problem. I saw a dude doing this at the computer shop. The guy was trying, and it was this guy's fault, right? He got infected with viruses, and he did something stupid to fix it, and he's yelling at the technician who's trying to figure out how to log into his account. And the guy doesn't remember his password because, of course, if you work with computers, you know everybody's password. We don't have any tech geeks here, do we? Because that's like a known thing. Well, of course I know the password for everybody who works at Rite Aid because I work in tech support. I'm all memorized. Anyway, people are yelling at him. But Moses had learned in his years of solitude how to tune out every other voice and listen to the only voice that matters at that moment of truth. In those moments of truth, you got the voice of the enemy, which is bad enough, the enemy within and the enemy without. But then you might have voices around you that are also trying to be helpful, but are not helpful. May even be quoting scripture in a way that's twisted and inappropriate for the current moment. I'm not saying it always is, but there are people that really are sincerely trying to help. But how many of you know there are some times that the only counsel that we should get is by tuning every other voice out and saying, okay, God, what are we going to do about this? What are we going to do about this? Because Moses by now knows, I didn't deliver these people. I'm carrying a stick and a God, but I didn't deliver these people. This was God's idea. So God, you got us here. How are we going to get out of this situation? And he's just that peaceful. You keep quiet. so I can listen to what God wants to say. Someone who has spent time with God becoming a real person. Not a person who does things because somebody taught me this. There's a phrase that I'm now attuned to when somebody says, well, you know, I was always taught that. It's time to lay that stuff away. Okay, maybe you were taught that, but what have you come to know? Right, this is part of moving into adulthood, both natural and spiritual. I was taught certain things, which means it made it to my brain. Maybe a little bit got into my heart. But what do I actually know? What do I actually believe? What's at the core of who I am that actually determines how I live my life? Because that's what drives life. That's the fuel behind life, what goes on in the heart. So someone who became a real person can stand firm on behalf of a panicked nation and impart peace even to an unbelieving people. There wasn't a single one. They were crying out to God and complaining in the same breath. That's the definition of two-faced hypocrisy. You talk about double-minded prayers. God help us, and we're going to die in the wilderness. That, you know, that's not, that don't work like that. That's what James said anyway. Don't pray and then pray believing. Pray a prayer of faith, but don't pray and then think that maybe it won't turn out the way you just prayed. You're not going to get anything like that. So Moses is there, and he imparted peace even to an unbelieving people. So he turns around, and he's praying. He's quietly just talking to the Lord, and God answers him. He's like, why are you crying out to me? It's like, Moses, this is no time for prayer. Like, wait, what? I thought you told me to pray without ceasing. You told me to talk to you about this stuff. What do you mean? Why am I crying out to you? Pharaoh, sea, wilderness, million people. That's why I'm praying. And all I got's a stick. God says, tell the sons of Israel to go forward. There's an ocean. Go forward. Only somebody who spent time with God can handle these kind of conversations with God. I think God's just funny sometimes, and he'll mess with us. He'll do something that's absolutely insanely impossible just to see our response. Because if our response is, like Moses back at the bush, nah, I can't do that, we miss out on so much. So much of what God has. I wonder how much in the world would be different right now if all the people of God did like Moses did. And you turn around, I guess Moses did it. Hey guys, forward march. And then God's like, all right, Mo, you ready for this? As for you, lift up your staff, stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it. And the sons of Israel will go through the midst of the sea on dry land. Only now did God reveal the plan. And the plan was, Moses, you got that stick in your hand? Yeah. Hold it out over the sea. It does that too? Well, it turns to snakes. Turns the water to, but it can part a sea? You mean the simple little thing in my hand that you gave me and empowered it, that can part an ocean? Do you mean to tell me, God, that little gift that you gave me can feed multitudes, that my few fish and loaves can feed 5,000 people? Yeah. You mean that my little leadership gift and my office and my three staff, that we could actually be a catalyst to make the company behave like heaven just invaded the place? Yeah. You mean just me and my five little prayer buddies here at my college, that we can fast and pray and seek God and actually change the atmosphere of an entire college campus, even in Philadelphia? Yeah. You mean to tell me that our little gathering of 200 people who comes together and seeks God together and builds family, that we can actually transform Lycans Valley to be a place where it looks like heaven just broke loose in the place? Yeah. Yeah. Stretch out your hand. Lift up your staff. Put that thing, little as you think it is. If God gave it to you and he anointed it, stretch it out. Put it out there for everybody to see. And watch what God's going to do when we step forward. See, because God said, tell the sons of Israel to go forward. You know, when Moses talked at the burning bush, I skipped over this thing. When he said, Moses, I'm calling you to go back. And Moses said, who am I? God said, I'm going to be with you. And this will be the proof that I'm with you. After you get free from Egypt, you're going to come and worship me on this mountain. Does that strike you as odd too? I'm like, that comedic pause. Like, wait, I don't think you get how this works, God. If you're going to do a sign, it's supposed to be like, you know, make the fleece wet and the dry and the ground dry and the fleece dry and the ground wet so that you prove to me that you're going to be with me. And God said, no, the proof's going to be that after you faithfully do what I tell you to do, you're going to come back to this mountain. So how many know sometimes we're waiting on God to do that fleece thing? I'm not against fleeces. Gideon did it and God did that for him. But friends of God don't need God to prove that his word is real and that he's not setting us up for a fall. Friends of God know God's voice well enough to say, all right, my answer is yes. What do you want me to do? That's friends of God. Friends of God have faith and confidence in God to say, you know, before you even say go, my heart's already there. I just need to know where. Just tell me which way to step. My heart's already in it. Tell them to go forward. So once we've met with God, we have a clear sense of his calling. The only limitation left is whatever we think in our mind. This staff doesn't just turn the Nile to blood. It doesn't just turn into a snake when you throw it on the ground. This staff, this anointing, this grace gift that God's given, yeah, it makes a way through where there seems to be no way. Over to the other side. Not just for us, but for all those who depend on us. So, you know, we have this saying, don't just stand there, do something. Most of the time when we do life like that, don't just stand there, do something. We do something, and then afterward we go, that was a dumb idea. I mean, it felt good to do something, right? It feels like, we gotta do something about this. Right? Every time there's a school shooting, yeah, we gotta do this. And it's this reactive kind of thing. The best thing to do is not just do something. Hold your ground. Stand firm. Don't let the situation move you away from Christ, away from his presence, away from a living understanding. He is in me. The one who's in me is able to do what looks impossible. Stand firm and see what you and God will do together. Don't just stand there, do something, says, I'm going to do this and hope God can keep up. That's what we say in the inside. Hope God can keep up with me because I'm a man of action. And God says, you know what? I am too, as a matter of fact. In fact, when God's introduced, it says he's moving over the surface of the waters. He's always moving. God's a man of action. When we partner with him, we come to that place of rest and we just say, okay, what are we going to do about this? Let's watch and see what God's going to do. So think of an impossible situation right now and let's pray. Lord, I pray that we would hear in our inner man the voice of the Father saying, what's that you got in your hand? That's good enough for me. Take our gifts, which you gave us. Take our calling, which you gave us. Take our personality, our upbringing, our past, the things that have happened to us. Take it all. We hold it now like a staff in our hand. And say, God, with this staff, with this stuff that you gave me from my life with you, by faith, I'm going to step out and do some wonderful things. That's why we call them signs and wonders, right? Because they're wonderful. I'm going to do some wonderful things. Take this staff and use it as a way to set this situation free, to see heaven break loose into it, to see this relationship restored, this workplace become like heaven, this valley become like heaven. We keep our hands open to you and together with you, we're eager to see where you're going to take us. Lead on, Good Shepherd. We got our staff in our hand too. Amen. Amen. If anybody needs prayer for anything, we're always available for that, by the way. I know we don't often do at the end of service an altar call. We just like interacting with God while we're in worship. But if you need prayer for anything, happy to pray with you. And there's a bunch of people. Raise your hand if you know how to pray for somebody. Anybody with their hand up right now? They're all good. So get some prayer before you go. Have an awesome week with Jesus. And don't forget to sign up before you leave. Love you guys.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. For more information on the ministry of Hillside Christian Fellowship, go to our website at www.hillsidechristian.org.